Turn with me to Revelation 13, if you would. Revelation 13. There's a scripture here, which, you know, the positioning is quite crucial. It's right in the middle of the Revelation 13, which is an insert chapter about Satan's church and system, coming right after Revelation 12, which is an insert chapter about God's church and system. And right in the heart of this particular passage, you find in verse 8, it says, "And all that dwell upon the earth shall worship him whose names are not written in the book of life, of the Lamb slain from the foundation of the world." Now, Christ slain from the foundation of the world, does that just apply to Passover? Of course it doesn't. If you actually go back and you look at each of the holy days, you go back in Leviticus 23 and you actually look at each of the holy days, you find that each of the holy days there was a lamb slain to remind them at that time of the fact that Christ was crucified and his burnt offering was given. And you can go back and you check each of the holy days, in addition to that, each of the days of unleavened bread, each of the days of the tabernacles as well. So in fact it wasn't just the fact that the Passover lamb was slain, it's the fact that the entire plan had to come into existence at that time. So when we're looking at the meaning of the day, sometimes it's a little bit difficult, because all sermons, as far as the feasts are concerned, are about the meaning of the day, about the meaning of the millennium and the rule of Christ at that time, and tabernacles. But what I'd like to do today on the meaning of the day sermon is to focus on two things, basically, because within the actual meaning of the day, or the meaning of the words used for the time of which we're meeting today, there are two words used. One is tabernacles, obviously, the Feast of Tabernacles, but there's also another word used, and the Feast of Ingathering. Those two words are actually used to describe these days that we're in. And if you turn back with me to Leviticus 23, I want to show you something else as well. In Leviticus 23, in verse 34, it says, "Speak to the children of Israel, saying, the 15th day of the 7th month shall be the Feast of Tabernacles, for 7 days unto the eternal." Now, the word for tabernacles there is the same as the word for booths in the Hebrew. Whether it means a tent, whether it means a temporary dwelling, well, it means a temporary dwelling, obviously. Whether it means a booth which is made out of branches of trees and so on, it doesn't make any difference. It basically is talking about a temporary dwelling. But I want you to notice what the reason was, what the reasoning is, as far as ancient Israel was concerned, for having the Feast of Tabernacles, having the booths. In verse 42, notice, it says, "And you shall dwell in booths 7 days. All that are Israelite born shall dwell in booths, that your generations may know that I made the children of Israel to dwell in booths when I brought them out of the land of Egypt. I am the Eternal, your God." Now, it doesn't sound really much like the reason we are keeping the Feast of Tabernacles, does it? And yet, in many ways, it does. It means a great deal to us. Because Israel dwelt in booths when it came out of Egypt physically. We are dwelling in booths now, as we've come out of sin spiritually. Because we now, this body that we've got, is not going to be here forever. And so many times we lose sight of that. You know, this body of mine is giving me problems. And quite frankly, we lose sight of that. The fact is that the Feast of Tabernacles has this as a focus as well. And it's a temporary time. And what I'd like to do is to just go through and show you the temporary nature of that and focus on these two names. First of all, on tabernacles and the temporary nature of things. And then on ingathering. And the permanent nature of things, because the harvest, the spiritual harvest, is what these days are all about. The ingathering, the time of the major harvest that needs to take place. So, as far as tabernacles are concerned, this temporary dwelling that we find ourselves in, the present, whatever present we actually have at the moment, is temporary. I mean, what we'll have as far as the present time is concerned, we're living in these condos, and we'll finally lock the door behind us. We'll leave the condo, we'll go back home again. So it's a temporary dwelling that we're actually in at the moment. And if you turn over to 1 Peter 2, we need to keep in mind that as we do this, as we actually leave our condos behind and close the door behind us and return home, so we need to remember that it also, that home that we're returning to is temporary. It's not going to be there forever. It's a temporary situation that we find ourselves in. And here in 1 Peter chapter 2, in verse 9, it says, "But you're a chosen generation, a royal priesthood, a holy nation, a peculiar people, that you should show forth the praises of him who has called you out of darkness into his marvelous light." See, we've been made into spiritual Israel. And we are keeping these days of tabernacles because of the same reasons as physical Israel. But it's a different application. Same reason is coming out of sin. It's coming out of Egypt, coming out of sin. We dwell in booths. We find ourselves right now dwelling in booths. "Which in times past were not a people, but are now the people of God, which had not obtained mercy, but now have obtained mercy. Dearly beloved, I beseech you as strangers and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts, which are war against the soul." It is the strangers and pilgrims that we are within this world. The temporary nature of this earth that we're in, the temporary nature of the present world that we find ourselves in, present civilization. And we need to keep that in mind. Even in ancient times, the book of Ecclesiastes was read specifically for this particular time of year, for these particular days, the days of tabernacles. And if you remember in Ecclesiastes 3, it talks about there's a time to be born, there's a time to die. Time to plant, time to harvest, time to kill, time to heal. And everything's got a time, and we've got a certain set time. It's interesting, Mr. Armstrong, when he was talking about this physical, chemical existence, remember? But when did he used to talk about that? He talked about the physical, chemical existence as he got older, as his own physical, chemical existence started to become apparent. You don't find him talking about that in the 50s, the 60s. You just don't. But when he got into the late 70s and early 80s, he was talking about that, because it's part of the lesson of life itself. And Ecclesiastes, a time to be born, a time to die, a time to plant, a time to harvest, a time to break and a time to build. It's there to teach us these lessons, that this is a temporary situation that we find ourselves in. And if we turn over a couple of pages to 2 Peter now, 2 Peter chapter 3, says, "This second epistle, beloved, I now write to you, in both which I stir up your pure minds by way of remembrance, that you may be mindful of the words which were spoken before by the holy prophets and of the commandments of us, the apostles of our Lord and Saviour." So again, pointing us back to the prophets, yes, but also to the apostles through which we learned the truth. "Knowing this first, that there shall come in the last days scoffers walking after their own lusts, saying, where is the promise of his coming? For since the fathers fell asleep, all things continue as they are from the beginning of the creation." In other words, it's the way it has always been, the way it's always going to be. And that's not the truth. That's not the way it is at all. "For this they're willingly ignorant." And believe me, the flood is certainly ridiculed today. You know, people don't believe in the flood at all. "For this they're willingly ignorant, that by the word of God the heavens were of old, and the earth standing out of the water and in the water, whereby the world that then was, being overflowed with water, perished. But the heavens and the earth, which are now, by the same word," the same one that made all things by commanding, you know, let there be light, and the atmosphere thinned, and the light started coming through, and let the dry land appear, and the dry land appeared. It presumably pushed itself up through the mantle of water that was on the earth at that time. "But the heavens and the earth, which are now by the same word, are kept in store, reserved to fire against the day of judgment and the perdition of ungodly men." So this same word that originally gave us gravity and the laws of the gravity, they also give the moral laws as well. And they also give a certain timing, the timing to the life that we have. And this is all part of the meaning of the day, the meaning of this time of life, of this time of the actual holy day plan of God. So it's necessary for us to remember that when we're looking at tabernacles, when we're looking at the Feast of Tabernacles and the meaning of the Feast of Tabernacles, We're looking at temporary dwellings. Yes, we're looking at temporary dwellings, but we're looking at the fact that the present is temporary. Another thing to keep in mind, as we're looking at temporary dwellings and the temporary nature of things, is the future tribulation. You know, we look in, with intrepidation at what's actually coming on the world, but the future tribulation is also temporary. It's a temporary time. It's going to be there for a certain length of time to reach the pinnacle of Satan's rule on earth, and then it's over. We move on then again. Turn back to Isaiah. I think at the feast we tend to read quite a bit of Isaiah, or even Isaiah. But the future tribulation is temporary. And here in Isaiah chapter 10, verse 24, it says, "Therefore thus says the Lord Eternal of hosts, O my people that dwell in Zion, don't be afraid of the Assyrian. He shall smite you with a rod, and he shall lift up his staff against you after the manner of Egypt." And in the manner of Egypt he'll also meet his demise as well. But it says, "For yet a very little while, and the indignation shall cease, my anger in their destruction." The tribulation is a temporary thing. It says, "The Eternal of hosts shall stir up a scourge for him according to the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb." That's the time of Gideon, if you remember. Gideon went down and fought together, you know, with clay pots and a candle and a torch, anyway, and a trumpet, and a handful of men routed the entire host of Midian, which, you know, covered the land thickly with, you know, an innumerable multitude of warriors. "And the Eternal host shall stir up a scourge for him according to the slaughter of Midian at the rock of Oreb. And as his rod was upon the sea, so shall he lift it up after the manner of Egypt." So the Eternal will destroy him. So what he's saying basically is the tribulation is temporary. It's a temporary thing, and we've got to keep that in mind as far as looking at these days are concerned. Our life is temporary, the tribulation that's coming is temporary. And let's turn over to Isaiah 26, just over a few more pages. Isaiah 26. And let's have a look at this, verse 19. "The dead men shall live, together with my dead body shall they arise. Awake and sing, you that dwell in the dust, for all the dew is as the dew of herbs, and the earth that shall cast out her the dead." So the actual context of this verse is dying, and the dead actually be resurrected in the future. But notice what it says. It says, in that context, "Come, my people, enter into the chambers, shut the doors about you, hide yourself, as it were, for a little moment, until the indignation be overpassed." So within the context of dying, he's saying, look, don't worry about it. These things are temporary. These things are temporary, and don't fret. "For behold, the Eternal comes out of his place to punish the inhabitants of the earth for their iniquity. The earth shall be disclosed her blood, and shall no more cover her slain." Because, you know, we were looking forward for the resurrection. And again, part of the meaning of these days is the fact that the tribulation is temporary. Everything is a season. It says in Ecclesiastes, everything has its own season, it has its own time. There's a time to be born, there's a time to die, there's a time to be, you know, pluck up what is planted, there's a time to plant. And everything has its own season. Turn over to Isaiah chapter 40, over a couple of pages, Isaiah 40. It says here in Isaiah 40, well, let's just pick it up in verse 25. But here in Isaiah chapter 40, verse 25, "To whom then will you liken me, or whom shall I be equal, says the Holy One? Lift up your eyes on high, and behold who has created these things, that brings out their hosts by number. He calls them all by names. By the greatness of his might, and for his strong in power, then not one fails." He is this being, you know, the one that we really have to put our trust in. He knows the stars by name. Now that just got a whole load more difficult for him. I don't know whether you know this, but in this past week, the Hubble telescope has actually discovered that there are 10 times the number of galaxies that they thought there were. I think it's 100,000 million, was it? Let's see. It's no, 200,000 million. And now it's 2,000,000 million. Or is it 1,000,000 billion? Anyway, basically, it's 2 trillion. So that's to 6, 12. One with 2 with 12 noughts after it. That's what they reckon it is. Before they crossed off a noughts. He's saying here, lift up your eyes on high, and behold who has created these things, that brings out the hosts by number. He calls them all by names, by the greatness of his might, that he should be strong in power, and not one fails. Now, how many billion on earth today? There's about, what is it? 5 billion? Is it 5? Something like that. 5 billion now. So you multiply that by 1,000 times to get 5 trillion. That's 1,000 times what there is on earth today for the number of stars. Now, when you think of that, look here in Isaiah 41, the next chapter. Notice in verse 10. Fear you not, for I am with you. Do not be dismayed, for I am your God. I will strengthen you. Yes, I will help you. Yes, I will uphold you with the right hand of my righteousness. So, in thinking that the coming tribulation is temporary, Israel itself, here is this being that knows every star by name. He therefore obviously knows every single individual Israelite by name that has ever lived. And it's not even coming close to the number of stars. So, can we see a little bit as far as us, our own position is concerned? God is acutely aware of us, acutely aware. He knows us individually by name, he knows us inside out. And there's absolutely nothing to worry about in that score. Even though, as I say, the tribulation is temporary, the present is temporary. It's part of the tabernacle that we're in. The tabernacle that eventually is going to be created permanent. It says, behold, all they that were incensed against you shall be ashamed and confounded. Yes, they shall be as nothing. They that strive with you shall perish. You shall seek them and you shall not find them, even them that contend with you. They that war against you shall be as nothing and as a thing that is naught. In other words, they're either going to go ahead and become friends, or they're going to go ahead and not exist. That's basically what's going to happen. For I, the Eternal, your God, will hold your right hand, saying unto you, fear not, I will help you. Fear not, you worm, Jacob, and you men of Israel. I will help you, says the Eternal, and your Redeemer, the Holy One of Israel, who knows every star by name, and so knows every Israelite by name, and knows everything about every Israelite by name, and how much more spiritual Israel by name. So the tribulation is temporary as well. But the other lesson, as far as tabernacles is concerned, the word tabernacles and the word booth, and understanding what is meant by that, is that the millennium and the last great day are also temporary. They're here for a while, they're here until they accomplish their purpose. And then God will move on. So even the last great day itself, turn over to Revelation 20, just remind ourselves what it says here. But in Revelation chapter 20, Revelation 20 verse 4, and I saw thrones, and they that sat upon them, and judgment was given to them. And I saw the souls of them who were beheaded for the witness of Jesus and for the word of God, and which had not worshipped the beast, neither his image, neither had received the mark upon their foreheads or in their hands. And they lived and they reigned with Christ 1,000 years. So the millennium is 1,000 years. Obviously, because the millennium means 1,000 years. But the millennium is temporary. It's a tabernacle. It's a temporary dwelling. It's a temporary booth. It accomplishes a certain purpose, and then it moves on in time as far as God is concerned. And that purpose will be accomplished. He says, the rest of the dead live not again till 1,000 years are finished, but this resurrection is the first of the resurrections. Blessed and holy is he that has part in the first resurrection. On such the second death has no power, but they shall be priests of God and of Christ, and they will be priests of God and Christ for 1,000 years. They shall reign with him as kings, obviously, for 1,000 years. So the millennium is temporary. And if we go back to Isaiah 65, now it's a little bit of speculation there, in Isaiah 65, insofar as it doesn't actually say it's 100 years, but it implies that there's 100 years in the actual great white throne judgment period. It says the permanence is verse 17, "For behold, I create a new heavens and a new earth, and the former shall not be remembered nor come to mind," because the former is something which is passing, which is transitory, which is tabernacles, which is booths. "The former shall not come to mind nor be remembered, but you be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create." Now eventually there's going to be a creation that'll be eternal, that'll be permanent. Now that part of the creation, as far as we're concerned right now, is what we can't see. It's what's going on inside. It's a spiritual side. And this is, again, part of the lesson of tabernacles. Part of the lesson of temporary booths, temporary dwellings. "But be glad and rejoice forever in that which I create." That's in the future. "Behold, I create Jerusalem." This is a new Jerusalem, "rejoicing, and her people a joy. And I will rejoice in Jerusalem and joy in my people, and the voice of weeping shall be no more heard in her, nor the voice of crying." Now that hasn't happened yet. Certainly in Jerusalem physically, it's not talking about that at all. But notice it goes on. It says, "There shall no more be thence an infant of days." This is a backward facing prophecy. It's focusing on New Jerusalem, and you go backwards a stage, and then you go backwards another stage, and you go backwards another stage until you come to chapter 66, where it's going back into our time now. And it's talking to us specifically. You know, those that tremble at your word, his word, your brethren that hated you, that cast you out for my name's sake, shall let the Lord be glorified. And that's in our day now. But here it says, "There shall no more be an infant of days, nor an old man that has not fulfilled his days. For the child shall die 100 years old, and the sinner, being 100 years old, shall be accursed." So the millennium and the last great day, the great white throne judgment, are temporary. The millennium is 1,000 years, the last great day appears to be 100 years long. And that's it. It's enough time to cause the purpose which is to be used to have developed. And that purpose is to show the contrast that there is. And we'll go on to that a little bit more when we look at the word ingathering. But the unseen is what is eternal, as I said. Now turn over to 2 Corinthians 4. Because this is implied through the word tabernacles. "Having seen what is temporary, we therefore ask, well, what is permanent?" Well, what is permanent is given, as I say, here in 2 Corinthians chapter 4. It says in verse 13, it says, "For we, having the same spirit of faith, as it is written, I believe and therefore I have spoken, we also believe and therefore speak, knowing that he which raised up the Lord Jesus shall raise us up by Jesus and shall present us with you. For all things are for your sake, and the abundant grace went through the thanksgiving of many redound to the glory of God. For which cause we faint not, for though our outward man perish," and believe me it is, it's perishing day by day, it says, "yet the inward man," or the inward character, "is being renewed day by day." And it's what you cannot see internally that is permanent. It goes on, "For a light affliction, which is but a moment, works for us a far more exceeding and eternal weight of glory. For while we look not at the things which are seen, but as the things that are not seen, for the things that are seen are temporary." And that's the lesson of this word tabernacles, the feast of tabernacles, the feast of booths. The things that are seen are temporary. We'll enjoy them. The millennium rule of Christ will be a wonderful time, a wonderful time. But it's there for a purpose. It's there to show the contrast between this society and this system and the future. And the future system, which is under Christ's rulership and under the word of God and the laws of God and the government of God, the ways of God. "While we look not at the things that are seen, but at the things which are not seen. For the things that are seen are temporary, but the things that are not seen are eternal. For we know that if our earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved," it's literally meaning a tent, he's talking about his own bodies now, all of our bodies were dissolved, "we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens." You know, when Christ returns, let's say, to what degree this is in existence at the moment, you know, the blueprints are certainly there. How much has actually been done on the construction of these bodies, I've no idea. It doesn't give us any indication. But we can be absolutely assured that when we are resurrected, the body will be there. The body, a glorified spirit body, and that's an eternal spirit body. A body that doesn't shake, the body that doesn't get it weary. You know, it renews its strength day by day. It probably has, as you move through it talks about the spirit, through the spirit God fills heaven and earth. Well, through the spirit, if God's filling heaven and earth, and we are our spirit beings, we flow through the spirit, because the spirit is there. Now the spirit is likened to air. We breathe air, and that air gives us energy. You know, the fish will swim through the water containing oxygen and gain energy from it. Is that something like a spirit being? That as we flow through the creation, we are energized continually? I don't know. No idea. No idea at all. But it says basically, we know that if this earthly house of this tabernacle were dissolved, we have a building of God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. It's in the heavens at the moment. At least the blueprints are. But it'll eventually be resurrected. We'll be resurrected with that body from the earth at the return of Christ. So what is unseen is eternal. And in this we groan, earnestly desiring to be clothed upon, or further clothed with the house which is from heaven. If so be that being clothed we shall not be found naked, for we that are in this tabernacle do groan, being burdened, not with that we should be unclothed, but we should be further clothed, as the literal original actually says, that we should be further clothed again, clothed upon, that mortality might be swallowed up in life, that this temporary dwelling that we find ourselves in today is just completely swallowed up, and in this living body, this vital, you know, vibrant, spirit-charged existence that we have. We can't even grasp it now. But this is all the meaning of tabernacles. Tabernacles is a temporary part of things. And yet here at the feast, what is permanent? Well, the prayer that you can't see. You know, we should be praying. We have got to be praying here at the feast. Because that is part of the permanence. That is what is vitally necessary. So don't neglect that by any stretch. You know, the feast, years ago, I remember in the 60s when my mother first started dragging us down to the feast in Hayling Island, all those years ago. There were sermons on every single day, twice. Every single day were twice. And on holy days, you got another one in the evening as well, that's three times. And to an 11-year-old boy, that did not really appeal. But you know, that's the way it was. That's the way it was. But you know, the reason that was the way it was is because my mother only had access to the sermons. That's the only sermons we ever heard for the year at all. And all you had, therefore, was the correspondence course and the booklets, because there's no tapes. You know, tapes hadn't been invented. The tapes that we had at home were big reels. And the big reels used to go through. And the only reason why we had one at home is because my father was reasonably wealthy. And we had that and cine films and that kind of stuff. But most people didn't even have that. They didn't have access to that kind of thing at all. There was no tapes. You couldn't have a sermon played. There was no broadcast in the UK at that time. Radio Luxembourg, we couldn't get Radio Luxembourg. I think Radio Man also came up later on. Couldn't get Radio Man. The Pennines were in the way. The Pennine range. And so that was it. It was the messages that were so vital. And that, on top of the three services, they also had Bible studies as well per day. And my mum used to go to that, and we didn't, my younger brother and I. But no, that was vital at that time. Today, that's not the case. If you want to hear a sermon, I've reckoned it up. You hear a sermon once a day for 6 years on our website. You know, if you want to go and listen to sermons, they're there. You can go ahead and listen to sermons so they come out of our ears. I think twice a day for 6 years or something. Anyway, whatever. But you can have a service every day if you wanted to. Turn over to Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16. Luke chapter 16, it talks in verse 1 to about verse 7, it goes into the unjust steward, which is, we won't go into specifically, but it says in verse 8, "And the Lord commended the unjust steward because he had done wisely. For the children of this world are in their generation wiser than the children of light." They're crafty. They know how to pull the angles, the strings. But there's the strings that we need to be pulling, there's the angles that we need to be making use of. Because it says, "And I say to you, make of you to yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness." You know, use the second tithe that you have to have people over into the condo. You know, compared to a hotel room, the condos are ideal. Ideal. This again is part of the reason I've said before that it is God who chooses the sites. Oh, it would be nice to have a beach with the hurricanes. The way it goes. But it'd be nice to have a beach, but a beach house and all the rest of it. And in the past, people have had that. But the condos that we have here, you know, staying in a hotel room, you can't have people back the same way. I mean, when we used to go travelling, and incidentally, you know, with my health the way it is, we haven't been travelling the way we have in the past, but you've had the added opportunity of having Mr. Forson go around, which has been I know many of you actually got to know the Forson, which is a plus and a bonus. With the new system, I'm hoping we should be able to have many of the other ministers giving some more sermons as well, which is, again, another bonus. But the condos allow us to have fellowship in a way, and you use a second tithe towards that end. It says, "And I say to you, make of yourselves friends of the mammon of unrighteousness." In other words, use your second tithe, get together, have that fellowship. "That when you fail, they may receive you into everlasting habitations." When you die, or whether you're resurrected as a, not resurrected as you, if you're changed, you'll actually be able to have eternal fellowships. You know, I always have in my back of my mind in the future that certain individuals getting together as spirit beings in the future and being able to get back to Jerusalem from the far side of the earth, having looked after your allotted 10 cities, 5 cities, 1 city or whatever, and all your little darlings are in bed, you can actually go back to Jerusalem and have fellowship with everybody else. Saying, "Oh, you never know, guess what happened to us today." I mean, but this is the way it'll be. These are the everlasting habitations. These are the kind of things that will take place. It'll be a condo in Jerusalem. There's a place in the New Jerusalem. Now, again, we call it kind of speculation. You know, when that wormhole or whatever it is, when the heavens roll back as a scroll, and it opens up, does it stay open for the entirety of the millennium? Is there, because they see Christ coming through that in the clouds of heaven, and I just wonder, does that stay open? Is New Jerusalem visible? You know, again, it doesn't say specifically, but you wonder. But there's a place in New Jerusalem. Is the parallel also the same, that in the Jerusalem that Christ will create, there's a place for us as well, that we'll have our own place, our own pad in Jerusalem, and we'll be able to come back to it and again get together. And as it says, when it says, "Make of yourself friends of the mammon of unrighteousness, that when you fail, then they may receive you into everlasting habitations." That's the kind of thing it's talking about. Eventually, New Jerusalem will land, will be brought down on the area of the earth, and it almost seems like a pyramid structure of some description. But it's going to be there, it's going to be real, and we are going to have a place within it. That's the permanence. That's the permanent aspect. Those are the everlasting habitations. But the tabernacles is to teach us that this time that we're in now, whether it's the present existence that we have within the world, or whether it's the future tribulation that we foresee and wonder about for our unconverted children and so on, or the millennium and the last great day, but these things are temporary. They're there for a certain degree, a certain purpose, and after that, we'll come on to, as it says here, these things which are eternal. There'll be an eternal body that will be given. There'll be an eternal character that is being developed now, unseen. But the effects are seen. But unseen, you can't see somebody's character, but you can see the effects of it. But these unseen things and the fellowship are all part of what is important, of what is really internal. But there is this other name as well for this time that we're in, these days, and the Feast of Ingathering. The Feast of Ingathering. Let's have a look at one of them over in Exodus 23. Exodus 23. It's only a couple of places that it actually mentions ingathering as a specific title for the time that we're in. But it mentions gathering fruit, as we read. So there's different phrases, phraseology of it. But here in Exodus 23, verse 14, it says, "Three times shall you keep a feast unto me in the year. You shall keep the Feast of Unleavened Bread. You shall eat unleavened bread 7 days, as I command you, in the time appointed of the month, Abib, for in it you came out of Egypt, and none shall appear before me empty. And the Feast of Harvest of the First Fruits of your labours." Now notice what it says, "The Feast of the Harvest of the First Fruits of your labours, which you have sown in the field, and the Feast," notice, "of Ingathering." So there are two feasts to do with harvests. One is the Feast of the Harvest of the first fruits, and the second is the Feast of Ingathering, which is at the end of the year, when you have gathered in your labours out of the field, and three times in the year shall your males appear before the eternal God. So this is being given and being used, the feast, calling these days the Feast of Ingathering, in contrast with the Feast of Pentecost, or the Feast of First Fruits, because one is a smaller harvest and the second is a larger harvest. Now, this parallel spiritually is concerned, it is a spiritual time of ingathering. It is the time that we are looking forward to, you know. These two harvests, if you turn over to James chapter 5, James chapter 5. If you remember when Christ was on this last day of the feast, "So any man thirst, let him come to me," and he said, "out of his belly will pour rivers of living water." And so the water is likened to the Holy Spirit, and it's clearly, that's over in John 7. But here in James chapter 4, it also uses the same analogy as far as water is concerned. It says, "You've lived in pleasure," in verse 5, "on the earth," that is James chapter 5, James chapter 5, verse 7. Verse 7. "Be patient therefore, brethren, unto the coming of the Lord. Behold, the husbandman waits for the precious fruit of the earth, and has long patience for it, until he receive the early and the latter rain. You also be patient. Establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord draws nigh." So this time of ingathering is the time of the latter rain. The time of first fruits is the time of the former rain. And you've got to have both times. You've got to have the early and the later rains as well. They give the two harvests. They give the vital ingredient towards the two harvests. And if you turn over to Deuteronomy 16, which we were in during the offering sermonette. But in Deuteronomy 16, in verse 16, "Three times in a year shall all your males appear before the eternal your God in the place that you shall choose." And that's the one that we tend to concentrate on. But over in verse 9, it says, "7 weeks shall be your number to you. Begin to number the 7 weeks from such time as you begin to put the sickle to the corn." So again, you're looking at harvest time and this primary harvest, this first harvest. "And you shall keep the Feast of Weeks unto the eternal your God," the Feast of the First Fruits, the Feast of Pentecost. And it's called the Feast of Weeks here. "With a tribute of freewill offering in your hand, which you shall give to the eternal your God, according as the eternal your God has blessed you. And you shall rejoice before the eternal your God." And down in verse 13, You shall observe the Feast of Tabernacles 7 days after that you have gathered in your corn and your wine, and you shall rejoice in your feast, you and your son and your daughter. So you have your early rain in Pentecost, in the Feast of First Fruits, the early rain, the first harvest, the lesser harvest. And then you have the latter rain, as far as that will produce, as it says in verse 13, after you've gathered in your corn and your wine. So as far as the corn is concerned, when he says corn, it's not talking about maize, it's talking about wheat. It's the old English corn that was used. And whether it refers to other, I'll have to look it up, but whether it refers to other grain as well, whether it refers to oats or barley, I'm not sure. But they didn't have maize when this was written in 1611. I don't think it had come across by that time anyway. But turn over to Leviticus 23 again. And in verse 14, it says, "And you shall eat neither bread, nor parched corn, nor green ears, until the selfsame day as you brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings." It's interesting that Christ, when he was walking through the cornfield, and his disciples plucked some grain, and they rubbed it in their hands and ate it, he gave the example to the Pharisees. This is a total aside, I don't know why this has come to mind, but gave the example to the Pharisees, who criticized the disciples for doing this, because as far as they were concerned, they were harvesting, they were gathering the grain, they were using it. He says, "Well, don't you remember, as far as David is concerned, eating the showbread, which is totally illegal, but that showbread was allowed by Christ for that specific instance. And as far as he was concerned, rubbing it, the grain between two hands wasn't harvesting, but it was allowed by Christ in that specific instance. Because if you go back to the original comment, you'll find that the Urim and Thummim was used, and the Urim and Thummim was certainly indicated to be used, and they checked it out, the priest checked it out before they allowed that bread to be used. But anyway, it says here, let's say, why not I bring that up? I've no idea, but it says in verse 14, "You shall eat neither bread nor parched corn nor green ears until the selfsame day that you brought an offering to your God. It shall be a statute forever throughout your generations in all your dwellings." And so Passover and the first of the first fruits, and then you go down to verse 17, "And you shall bring out of your habitation 2 wave loaves, 2 tenth deals, and they shall be of fine flour, they shall be baked with leaven." And we are all baked with leaven. We still have the battle and the problems that we do, and this is certainly a sign of the church at this time. That are the first fruits to the eternal. And then, if you don't, so in verse 39, "And in the 15th day of the 7th month, when you gather in the fruit of the land, you should keep a feast for the eternal 7 days. On the first day shall be a Sabbath, and for the 8th day shall be a Sabbath." So it's the time when you've gathered in the fruit of the land. It's the ingathering. Say, you don't necessarily find the word ingathering used, but you do find the words such as this one here. And when you've gathered in, you just got the words the other way around, that's all. But there are two harvests clearly indicated, and they are dependent on the early and the latter rain. And the two harvests that we have indicated, the harvest that we are in at the moment, the first fruit harvest, and also the harvest in the future, which is the harvest of ingathering, the tabernacles period, which is the beginning of it's from trumpets on, isn't it? But it's the beginning of the major harvest, the latter rain that produces it. But this time of ingathering, it fits within a big plan, a huge plan. Now, put in your notes, I don't have time to read, but over in 1 John 3, verse 8, it talks about destroying the works of the devil. And certainly that is part of the plan, very much part of the plan, because the world at the moment is at one with Satan. If we turn over to Matthew chapter 12, Matthew chapter 12, in verse 42, In verse 42, the queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation, and shall condemn it, for she came from the uttermost part of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And behold, a greater than Solomon is here. When the unclean spirit is gone out of a man, he walks through the dry places seeking rest and finds none. It's not just a case of getting rid of Satan and locking Satan up. It's not even a case of just getting rid of Satan's broadcast that is crucial to the equation, even though both is absolutely vital. But that broadcast has got to be replaced. And, you know, God hates a vacuum, nature hates a vacuum, as the saying goes. It's got to be replaced with the very Spirit of God. And so it's not just getting rid of Satan's broadcast, it's having the Spirit of God made available to us, to all mankind, and poured out on all flesh. It says, when the unclean spirit, you know, notice what he's saying, the queen of the south shall rise up in the judgment with this generation and shall condemn it, because she recognized the time, you know, the wisdom of Solomon that was there. But when an unclean spirit has gone out of a man and walks through the dry places seeking rest, finding none, then he says, I'll return to my house from which I came out. When he comes, he finds it empty, swept and garnished. So it's clean. You got rid of the unclean spirit. But he says he then goes and takes himself seven other spirits and wicked and more wicked than himself, and they enter in and dwell there. The last state is that man is worse than the first. Even so shall it be also to this wicked generation. Christ was there getting rid of wicked spirits. But they were rejecting him. They were rejecting his other message, which was a spirit-driven message, the message that came from the Spirit of God. They were rejecting that, accepting one, rejecting the other. And without that, they're left in an even worse position than before. And this is the problem. They're left in a worse position than before. You know, there's no vacuum there. The broadcast has got to be replaced. It's going to be replaced at the time of ingathering by the Spirit of God, the accessibility to the Spirit of God. It says here, in other words, it indicates here, what they should have done is not just accepted the fact that they pushed all the evil spirits out of the land, but they puts the right spirit into place and put the way of life that came from that spiritual source into place. And then they would be protected. And so if we turn back to Isaiah 32, this is a classic one. In verse 1 it says, behold, a king shall reign in righteousness and princes shall rule in judgment. And it says in verse 14, it says, because the palaces shall be forsaken, the multitude of the city shall be left. The forts and the towers shall be for dens. It says forever. It literally means to the dim and unseen future. That's literally what the word means in the Hebrew. So the towers shall be for dens to the dim future. A joy of wild asses, a pasture of flocks, until the Spirit be poured out upon us from on high. So this time of ingathering is a time for the Spirit to be poured out on high. And that Spirit who is going to be in the wilderness becomes a fruitful field. The fruitful field becomes counted as a forest. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness and righteousness remain in the fruitful field. And the work of righteousness shall be peace. And the effect of righteousness, sweet quietness and assurance forever. This time of ingathering, this time of that Satan is put away and the broadcast is removed, it's also a time that the Spirit of God is poured out. And that Spirit of God comes in from on high. So instead of being at one with Satan, the world becomes at one with God. It's the two together, two things together. It's getting rid of Satan and the return of Christ. It's getting rid of his broadcast and the availability of the Spirit of God. That's the ingathering. That's the time. It's a latter rain. It's the former rain that is severely limited to the first fruits, which is just those that God specifically calls. But the latter rain is for all mankind. And if we turn over to Ezekiel 28. It's part of the big plan. This is part time of ingathering, is the defeat of Satan's way completely. It's part of the aversion therapy. That's when you think of of Adam and Eve and the way in which Christ had to fast for 40 days and 40 nights before meeting Satan. And yet Adam went in. I mean, how long had Adam been created? Adam and Eve had been created? 2 days? A day and a bit? And yet then they were subjected to Satan. When Christ, with all his knowledge, with all his power, you know, had the Holy Spirit without measure, took him 40 days of fasting before he was ready to confront Satan. It was a foregone conclusion what was going to happen in the case of Adam and Eve. You know, you don't go in to meet Muhammad Ali. Now that dates me, doesn't it? I don't know who else the other ones are, but you don't go in to fight Muhammad Ali unprepared. It just doesn't work that way. But here in Ezekiel 28, we see the problem that the last great day and the millennium, time of ingathering, what the time of ingathering is all about. It's to prepare the world for the last great day, to have the contrast between the two systems. The one is the at one with Satan, the system that we are currently in today, in this age today, but the other will be at one with God. And the contrast between the two is what people at the last great day are going to rise up into. And they'll be able to see the contrast. So the time of the ingathering, it's ingathering during the millennium, yes, but it's more than that. It's preparing people ready to help others as they are resurrected. It's a time of ingathering throughout that entire period of the millennium and the last great day. And this is what they're countering. This is what they're actually going against. It says in verse 15, "You were perfect in your ways from the day that you were created until iniquity was found in you." So it's God's law, God's government, God's way of life that is the problem. And it says in verse 17, "Your heart was lifted up because of your beauty." You've got his mind in the wrong perspective. "Because of your beauty, you've corrupted your wisdom." There's an insanity there. "By the reason of your brightness, and I'll cast you to the ground, and I'll lay you before kings that they may behold you." So it's the total removal of Satan's way. It's part of this big plan. And the aversion therapy involved. The aversion therapy that we never ever will go back. When Satan went ahead and chose the way of life that he went ahead and chose, he did not have a broadcast. And when I say he didn't have a broadcast, I mean he wasn't subject to a broadcast the way we do are today. He went and chose that way knowingly, willingly, willfully. There was no broadcast there. He wasn't being pushed, he wasn't being pulled, he wasn't being cajoled, as the world is today, to go a certain way. He went willfully. And this is it. Your heart, and what was the trigger? Well, your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You know, these glorified bodies that we'll be given in the future, our heart could be lifted up because of our beauty, if it were not for this aversion therapy that takes place. So this aversion therapy that takes place is a vital ingredient within the plan of God. You know, Christ being sacrificed from the foundation, from the throwing down of the world. And that word for foundation in Revelation 13, literally means thrown down. I brought it out before, but the way they used to build foundations was they dig a trench, they get down to some clear soil, or clear mud, not mud, clear clay, and then they take huge rocks and throw them into the foundation and to bed them in, to get rid of any air that's there, and then build on that foundation. So there'd be these huge rocks that they'd throw into the foundation. So the word throw down and the word foundation is the same word in Greek. Because that's how the foundation was made. But from the foundation of the world, from the throwing down of this age, the time that Adam took to himself the knowledge of good and evil, from that time, Christ was sacrificed, had to be sacrificed. Let's say, it was a foregone conclusion that would be the case. Because when you're looking at the situation of facing Satan, and the way in which Christ himself had to fast for 40 days and 40 nights, and yet he allowed Adam and Eve to go ahead and be confronted by Satan totally unprepared, and the outcome was foregone. I mean, it was known But from that point, it wasn't just Christ's sacrifice, it was the entire plan had to come into being. The entire plan, every single stage of the plan, including this time of ingathering, including the time of ingathering, including the early reign, the former reign that we are in now, the position that we hold today, that also had to be determined. But it is all to do with your heart was lifted up because of your beauty. You have corrupted your wisdom by reason of your brightness, by getting your center wrong, by having the focus in the wrong place. And it is the total removal of Satan's way and the aversion therapy involved that is so vital as far as the big plan is concerned when we're looking at this time of ingathering, this festival of ingathering. The millennium itself, however, turn back to Isaiah chapter 6. Isaiah 6. The millennium itself begins in chaos, as we read earlier on over in Isaiah 32. The Spirit is until the Spirit is on high. But here in Isaiah 6, it also has something similar to say. In verse 9, he said, "Go and tell this people." It's verse 9 of Isaiah 6. "Go and tell this people, hear you indeed, but understand not. See indeed, but perceive not. Make the heart of this people fat, make their ears heavy, and shut their eyes, lest they see with their eyes and hear with their ears, and understand with their heart, and convert and be healed." And then they said, "Oh Lord, how long?" In other words, how long is this time is going to be going on for, where they're deliberately deceived, where they're deliberately withheld from the knowledge of the truth? How long will that time go on for? And he said, "Until the cities be wasted without inhabitants, and the houses without men, and the land is utterly desolate." In other words, until the tribulation comes and the world is going to be desolate and at that time. Why? Because it's got to be that the system that Satan's world is embracing comes to its fruition. You've got to be able to see that. Once you're able to see that, then the time is ripe. And there's a time to live and there's a time to die. There's a time to gather stones, there's a time to put... throw stones away. There's a time for chaos, quite frankly, in the world. Why? Because of a certain frame of mind, a certain mindset, a certain broadcast. There's a time of restitution of all things. The time of the ingathering, the big plan being implemented. So the millennium begins in chaos. It says in verse 12, it says, "And the Eternal has removed men far away, and there's a great forsaking in the midst of the land. But yet it shall be that a tenth, and it shall return, and shall be eaten like a teal tree, as an oak whose substance is in them, when they cast their leaves, so the holy seed shall be the substance thereof." Opposite us we have a wood here at home, and it's a coppice wood. Do you have coppicing over here? Okay, well basically what do you do with coppicing? You chop the trees down. And if you chop the trees down, the tree will then sprout all the way around the stump that's there. And so you get what these things are called, these sprouts, are called coppices. And it's a means that they used to have years ago for getting the maximum amount of woodland out of the area. And so you coppice. And then you chop those down, and they sprout again. You do it every 10 years, something like that. So you get logs which are 10 rings big, maybe 10, 15 years, something like that. And it's been coppiced for years, centuries, predominantly ash. And this is what it's talking about here. It says that you return and be eaten as a teal tree, as an oak, whose substance is in them, when they cast their leaves, so the holy seed shall be the substance thereof. You know, a tree, when you chop it down, it'll sprout again. And it'll sprout and, you see, it hasn't died. Well, even though the cities are wasted without inhabitants, the houses without man, even though there's only a tenth left, nevertheless, it'll sprout again. And from that tenth, you'll have the time of ingathering. You know, go into the actual focus of the entire purpose of mankind. Understanding, living under Satan's way is the aversion therapy. That's what it's all about. And if you turn back with me to Revelation chapter 6, That's what they're saying. The millennium begins in chaos. The Revelation chapter 6. Here's the sixth seal in verse 12. I beheld when he had opened the sixth seal, and lo, there was a great earthquake. Now, this is the heavenly signs that occur at this time. But there's also something else. There's a great earthquake, and the sun became as black as sackcloth as hair, and the moon became as blood. To mention, there have been earthquakes. Oklahoma, there's all kinds of earthquakes at the moment. There's earthquakes all over the place. But this one is something noteworthy. This one is going to be really a humdinger of an earthquake. And if you go on a little bit further, and you find that that's not the only one mentioned in the end time. Turn over to chapter 16. In chapter 16, this is right before, these are the seven last plagues. And it's right at the end of the seven last plagues, right before the entire thing comes crashing down around everybody's ears. And they've already had an Armageddon over in verse 16. And then verse 18, and there were voices and thunders and lightnings, and there was a great earthquake. So there'd already been one with the heavenly signs that was noteworthy. But this one is different again. There's a great earthquake such as was not since men were on the earth, so mighty an earthquake and so great. And the great city was divided into three parts, and the city of the nations fell, and the great Babylon came to remembrance before God to give her the cup of wine of the fierceness of his wrath. And every island fled away, and the mountains were not found. It's going to restructure the entirety of the earth. And in that chaos, then the time of ingathering can start. And you imagine the people there, you know, the temporary dwellings, you're teaching them about temporary dwellings. I mean, there aren't any dwellings. The dwellings are all gone. And you're teaching them at that time, you know, most of humanity at that time is going to be dead. You know, at the very bare minimum, 9 out of 10 will die. And it's a result of Satan's way, and a result of Satan's system. But then, what will then take place is that the entire spiritual utopia, and a physical utopia as well, an abundance such as never been seen before. And turn over to Isaiah 51. Isaiah 51. Listen to me, you that follow after righteousness, that seek the eternal. Look to the rock where you have hewn, and the hole of the pit where you dug. Look to Abraham your father, and to Sarah that bare you, and I called him alone, and blessed him, and increased him. For the eternal shall comfort Zion. He will comfort all her waste places, and he will make her wilderness like Eden. So though it'll be chaos initially, absolute chaos, the cities will be flattened, there'll be virtually no... You know, you look at Syria, look at what's happened in Syria. It always reminds me of Lebanon. Lebanon is very much the same way. There's a continual wars in that place. And Salam Madani, wasn't it? Yeah, Salam Madani and Judy. They were two individuals, Salam and Judy Madani, they were married with their children, flying back from a feast into Lebanon. And Lebanon at that time, in the 60s, 70s, 70s, early 70s, Lebanon at that time was a paradise. It was a holiday destination. It was something like, something like Florida for you in the States. And it was a wealthy country as well. Lebanon was this financial capital at that time. And as the plane went in to land, a rocket hit it and you know, blew it out of the sky. And yet at that time, you couldn't understand why would God allow this couple and the children to die. And yet, since that time, Lebanon has had war after war after war, and they were taken out of it. And same with Syria, same with Syria. But here it says that Zion, this chaos that you find at the end of the age, the earthquakes flattening everything, the chaos that they have in the cities, the chaos in the world. It says here, verse 3, then he'll make her wilderness like Eden, and a desert like the garden of the eternal. Joy and gladness shall be found therein, thanksgiving and the voice of melody. So that abundant physical and spiritual utopia is what is destined for that time. Turn over to Isaiah 35. Turn back to Isaiah 35. And Isaiah 35, verse 10. What is aimed, when it talks about in verse 9, no lion shall be there, nor any ravenous beast shall go up thereon, shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the redeemed of the eternal shall return, and come to Zion with songs, and everlasting joy shall be on their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. So when we're looking at this ingathering, this time of ingathering, that's what's destined for the time. And let's turn over finally over to Isaiah 32 again. Isaiah 32. Just remember what it says about a king reigning in righteousness and princes ruling in judgment. And here in verse 13, upon the land of my people shall come up thorns and briars, yes, upon all the houses of joy in the joyous city. So there's the chaos that will be at the beginning of the millennium. Because the palaces shall be forsaken, the multitude of the city shall be left. The forts and towers shall be from dens into the dim and distant past in a future. A joy of wild asses, a pasture of flocks, until the Spirit be poured out to us on us from on high, and the wilderness be a fruitful field, and the fruitful field be counted as a forest. Then judgment shall dwell in the wilderness. Righteousness remain in the fruitful field, and the work of righteousness shall be peace, and the effect of righteousness, quietness and assurance forever. And so we see this time of ingathering, this last great harvest, will be a time when peace and assurance forever. It's a time of the tabernacles, from the temporary physical tabernacles to permanent dwelling places of the Godhead. That's what we're looking at. As far as tabernacles are concerned, physically, yes, it's temporary, but it's the permanence is there. And that's very much part of the meaning of the day that you find within these two words of tabernacles, I didn't gather it.